screwing up. I'm tired of going down. I'm tired of myself. 88.5
FM, KCSN, and KCSN HD1 Northridge, Los Angeles. KSBR and KSBR HD1 Mission Viejo. A service of California State University Northridge and Saddleback College. Member-supported public radio. Streaming on the web at thesocalsound.org.
We're listening to the theme music for the hit TV series 24. A very happy Wednesday evening to you all, and welcome back to The Soundtrack. I'm your frequently peculiar host, Lavelle Spiro, and tonight we have the honor of speaking with multiple award-winning TV and film composer, Sean Callery. Sean, thank you so much for being here.
Lev, it's great to see you as always. Wonderful to see you.
I'm not sure about the seeing reference. We're on the radio, you know that, right? But we are in the same
place. Can I get this out of the way? I cannot grow a mustache. You have the best mustache in the business. I wish I could be that. Can we? You got to make a podcast.
Thank you. Tell my wife. Okay, you told me you had won a few awards for your work, but you were being modest to the point of outright lying. Okay, so when I looked up your IMDb page, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. Just from ASCAP, that's for our listeners, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, you have won 10 awards between 2003 and 2016, including TV Composer of the Year, Most Performed Themes and Underscore, and Top TV Series for Medium, Elementary, Bones, and 24. You've won a Gemini Award. You've won a World Soundtrack Award, an International Film Music Critics Award, multiple awards from the Online Film and TV Association, and we haven't yet gotten to the big kahuna, the Emmys. I know you've heard of those. Okay, so this is crazy. You have been nominated 17 times. 17 times! And won 4 Primetime Emmy Awards, 3 times for Outstanding Composition for the Series 24, which we're listening to right now, and most recently for the main title music for Jessica Jones. So do they just keep a seat reserved for you at the Emmys now?
Oh, you're so kind. Absolutely not.
Is it just like they keep, even years you're not nominated, it's like, no, that's Sean's seat, and we have a seat filler for this year, but he's going to be back.
You know, no, the seat has been given up. I mean, I'd love to get back there one day, but there's so much great, so many great people out there and great music. I mean, I caught away for a while there with such a hit show. It was so wonderful. And then Jessica Jones, can we get this out of the way? Was the showrunner was...
Oh, no, we're not going to reveal that until later in the show.
Okay, yeah, very good. Okay. I keep that quiet.
Yeah, right, it's going to be a mystery. But this, you know, I'm reminded of photos I've seen of, like, the North Korean generals in full dress uniform. If you had a medal for every award nomination and win, you wouldn't even be able to stand up, man. You'd just fall over on your face. Yeah. Okay.
That's very kind of
you.
Yeah.
Now that I'm done embarrassing you, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Are you a California boy or a transplant? And at what age did you decide you were going to pursue a career in music?
This is great. Oh, this is wonderful. You're playing the music from Bones. That's wonderful.
Almost like it was planned.
It was planned. Raised in Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
Classical piano training. Went to New England Conservatory.
Uh-huh.
But from a very... from very, very, very young age, it was. I noticed film music. I noticed it in Carl Stalling's Bugs Bunny cartoons and John Williams's Lost in Space.
Wow!
It just hung out there for me. It just intrigued me, and it I remember it really well. You know,
I hate talking over this music because it's gorgeous, but I do want to talk to you. But wait, let's listen for a second. Bring this up.
Can I just say that was from the 200th episode that was sort of paying a homage to the the Bernard Herrmann and the jewelry heist movies.
You mentioned to me it was intended as an ode to Bernard Herrmann. I just wanted to let our listeners know, Herrmann, of course, was a great American composer.
Yes.
Probably most famous for composing the scores to multiple Hitchcock films, I think six in all, including Vertigo and Psycho, two of his most famous. He also did Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, a lot of people think the greatest movie of all times, and as well as Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver and many more.
Yeah.
Was he a great inspiration to you?
Yes. Let's just leave it at that. I mean, you know, his scores are, they continue to inform. You know, when you hear Psycho, when you hear Taxi Driver, I mean, it's just, they're living things. They just continue to inspire. You know, that's the way I feel about him as a composer.
And he was very much a classical composer. His biggest influences, according to my good friend Wikipedia, were Wagner and Stravinsky. And I know that you're a huge fan of classical music because, well, you and I have gone to hear the LA Phil on multiple occasions.
Yes.
How much does classical music inform your writing?
Well, I mean, my training, my colleagues have all come into this from different avenues. I came at it through a classical education, so I went to the New England Conservatory in Boston, but at the age of 18, I had never heard Stravinsky, for example. And when I heard The Rite of Spring, if anybody hasn't heard that yet, it sort of just blew your mind wide open. It was sort of intoxicating and passionate, and I hear a lot of things in there that just I think you'd hear them in people, composers would have been inspired for them. For their films, you hear a lot of that going on.
Well, I just happen to have a section of The Rite of Spring.
You do?
Queued up. I do, from 1921, from Igor Stravinsky. So, guys, check this out. You and I both heard Esa Pekka Salonen conduct this. It was one of his signature pieces.
Yes.
More recently, we heard Dudamel conduct it, which was at least equally as thrilling.
Yes.
So let's listen to this. This is it's about a minute long. It is called Scenes of Pagan Russia, Part 1, Dance of the Earth.
I'm leaving.
don't leave.
Just
we're just starting.
Playing. I mean, there's nothing more inspiring than to hear that and say, I'm done. Like, you could.
Music is so adrenalizing. It's thrilling. And folks, I know this is not a classical radio station, but if you love great music and you have a chance to hear that performed live, don't miss it. You'll thank me later.
Absolutely.
And to my ears, it still feels very fresh, like that could have been written in 2024, not 1921.
I agree. I completely agree. I mean, I got goosebumps hearing it. And it's just to perform it. We've heard it live. When you hear it live, there's the air pressures and the change.
Yeah.
And you know, there's such a difference in what you're physiologically experiencing.
Yeah.
So I wholeheartedly, everybody listening has to go to Rite of Spring.
And you probably know that Stravinsky lived for 30 years here in Los Angeles. Did you know that?
I did. And he also had an apartment on my street in Boston when he was doing the Rite of Spring.
He's kind of following you around in a weird time travel kind of way.
Reverse. I think I'm following him.
Well, here he lives. He lived on 1260 North Weatherly Drive. It's just off Bohemian Sunset. I looked this up.
Wow.
We should go like make a pilgrimage or something. You know, we could play that piece, maybe guitar and bongos or something. You know. Okay. Listen, I want to put some more of your work in our listeners'
ears. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
We're following that with my score. Oh, what is going on here?
Well, you agreed to come on the show.
I did not.
I'm sorry.
I'm kidding. It's all right.
Let's start with this one. This garnered you one of your several thousand Emmy nominations, and this is the main title theme for the series Elementary. You know, I've expressed this to you before, Sean, that people who do what you do, that write music and create these things from paper that become these airwaves in our heads, these amazing abstract art forms, it's like magic to me. I don't know how you do this. So tell us about this. How did this come about? Where did you start with it?
When I read the script, I spoke to the director, and oftentimes for me, the director, Michael Cuesta, he just says certain words. Sometimes a director will say a word that just sort of plants a seed.
Okay.
And you follow it. The thing I thought about Holmes when I read the script is the very first time we see Holmes, played by the amazing Johnny Lee Miller, he's looking at six different broadcasts on TV and remembering each thing that's on.
So this is an updated Holmes. Holmes now lives in New York City in the present day.
Right, and okay. Lucy Liu played Watson. It was a great show. It ran for 8 years. I loved working on that series. And there was something about the way he was looking at all the different televisions, all the different lines that were being spoken. It reminded me of Fugues, you know, lines of I was thinking Baroque. I was thinking there are different lines going on, and he's a brilliant person. And I was thinking he's solving things in different ways, you know, different lines working simultaneously. Because playing Fugues, it is written that Bach was able to improvise up to five or six fugues.
Yeah.
You could do a fugue on the spot.
Alien.
Yeah, exactly. So there's precision. I thought the word, there was a lot of precision. So that, that piece has a lot of brittle ding, 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 and Holmes in the end had kind of a plucky, fastidious sound in the cello, which sort of served the series.
Well, I love the way you're interweaving the rhythmic elements there, the different string parts, the harp, the synthesizer.
Yes.
Was there a deliberate progression? You start with a kind of 19th century array of strings, and then you bring that synth into it. Was that to bring it into the modern era? Or
yeah, I think the theme was worked out sort of on the piano, and then I tried to translate it, you know, to in the box, what we say, you know, samplers and things of that nature. The synthesizer, I thought, was a way to kind of shake it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, Rob Doherty, the showrunner, didn't like it. He didn't like it. And so it was taken out for the show. But I always,
this is the composer's version.
I keep the preferred version of that little bit. And
I love that.
And I tried to lower it and stuff. And you know, I wasn't trying to fool him. I just wondered if maybe it was a mix issue. And he was just like, you know, I think I just want it cleaner. You know, and so out it went. But it remains here.
Very cool. And then I was wondering also. Is that you've kind of, I think you've explained that about the different TV sets and the fugue element of it.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if you had done a deliberate kind of procedural element. And I should explain, my wife keeps telling me that I'm using terminology from film and TV that people don't necessarily know. So a procedural refers to a kind of show that focuses on a specific process, often within a professional field such as law enforcement or medicine or the legal system. Now that you're talking about it, I think that's not it. It was just the fugue state that you're talking about.
The show is the show, and it was technically a procedural. There was a murder or a crime or a mystery, and Holmes and Rob Doherty, to his credit, I have to give a shout out to him as the showrunner. He just wrote these delicious riddle mysteries, and when you got to Act Four, when you're spotting, I really didn't know how it was going to end. You know, it's lovely to have that kind of. Not knowing when you're spotting a show, when you're spotting by the way, is looking at a show, sort of bone dry, and deciding where the music's going to go.
You didn't throw a hissy fit and go, I must know how this ends before I finish my masterpiece.
Well, sometimes I would throw out in the middle of Act Two, I'd say, oh, he did it. And I would have no idea. And so, and the editor, the picture editor, would go, now, how did you know that? I said, I didn't know that. I said, I just, because they think their editing is producing a tell.
Right.
That somehow the acting or the performance. But no, I just would throw it out. And maybe 20% of the time I hit a bullseye.
That's very funny.
You have to laugh a little bit in this.
I think that we should listen to that again. It's like a 45-second cue, and it's really cool. Let's hear that one more time, though, we're talking about it.
And the imagery was one of those Rube Goldberg machines that was doing all this really elaborate science and so forth. That's also very inspiring when you see graphics. You know, does it work? Does it inspire you? But I did start working on the theme before we got the main title. And that's only 30 seconds. There's a 3-minute version, but that never gets played.
So you are a pianist
at
heart, and that's what you compose on?
Pretty much, yes. Yeah.
This is very important, by the way. Diction is very important when you're using that terminology. Yes. Pianist. To pronounce the T's.
Yes.
But so going back to classical music, clearly you were trained at a young age. Do you think, is that an overt influence when you're writing? Do you, like in this case, you said, oh, it reminded me of a Bach fugue, and it's something that you try to write towards, or is it more of a constant subliminal influence that has an effect on all the music you write?
I think your journey as an artist of any kind, and for me it just happened to follow the classical path, is just a part of your journey whether you know it or not. I would say that if this show was in the hands of someone who came from a more, just for the sake of example, a rock and roll or a band background, they would have done something just as authentic. It would have been speaking to their DNA and how it came about. For me, I will say, having studied classical, and this is just an opinion, not a fact, I'm going to make that clear, whenever I'm asked to explore another genre of some sort, having studied classical, for some reason, it allowed me access to at least sort of think about, well, what's 12-tone music or impressionistic music, or we're going into rock and roll, any style really, but the foundational training that I got, and I've got so much more training to do, by the way, I wasn't an A student at the New England Conservatory. I didn't go in there. I knew I was not going to be Vladimir Horowitz going in there. As a matter of fact, I knew going in there I wanted to compose, but I just didn't have any experience with that. So you go to war with the army you have, so to speak, you know, with the skill set you have.
Well, the next track I want to share is very different than what we've heard so far. When I listen to it, I still hear the classical piano in it, but the whole piece is jazz-based. So this is we're going to play this theme. This is the main theme, once again nominated for an Emmy, for the drama series Homeland. Here it is. We are here talking to famed composer Sean Callery. You're listening to the soundtrack on the SoCal Sound. Sean, the first time I heard that piece, I had the impression that you'd put together a jazz combo and improvised a lot of it, because it sounds very authentic, but I've listened to it a bunch of times. Now I think you scripted it all note for note. Where's the truth in there?
First of all, I was completely stoned when I wrote that. I'm kidding. I'm joking. Can we not do that?
Don't do drugs.
I wasn't. But when I hear it, it's got it such a... I haven't heard it in a while, and you are absolutely right. That piece, a lot of how that piece sort of arcs, had something to do with the way the imagery of the main title started coming in, which if you ever see the main title of Homeland, it starts with a sleeping young girl, which is Carrie Matheson as a young person. And over the course of the 1 minute and 17 seconds, you see all these trauma that's happened in the world in terms of terrorist activity. And the most one of the most traumatic things you see is the Twin Towers burning, you know, which was a very disturbing image. And that is the highest trumpet note in the piece. And the idea was that that is sort of like a wailing. It's sort of like a crying out. Normally that image, normally imagery like that more traditionally would be like action, you know, this is like turmoil and tension. And so
how did you decide on a jazz inflected track for a show about a CIA operative in the Middle East?
Well, the script, I will say, I had a dinner, and it was with, again, Michael Cuesta, the director, Alex Gonza, Howard Gordon, and myself. And that's sort of where you have to kind of show your cards in terms of what you're thinking. I'd read the script. It was in the script that she listened to jazz. And it was also in the script that she had a bipolar condition.
Right.
And one of the things that kind of stood out to me, I have people in my life who have a bipolar condition. And there are qualities sometimes that are of... There's impulsivity, there's spontaneity, there's unpredictability. Certain idioms in jazz have that. When you're improvising, when you're at a really wonderful concert and someone's about to solo, they don't know what they're going to do.
Right.
And you're discovering it as they discover it. And so it was sort of an interesting fit that the writer of the episode, and I forgot who it was, already sort of assigned that she was into jazz. I don't know if there was any research done into that. So it kind of stuck. And the score itself, over the course of the years, wasn't jazzy per se. It sometimes reared its head, but it has its color in the main title mostly.
I thought I was being so smart when I asked you a couple weeks ago. I was like, so, you know, I know that she's struggling with bipolar disorder. Is that why you had the trumpet playing in a minor key while the bass and piano are in a major key? And you were like, no.
You know. I didn't say that. I said, you know what? Maybe.
That's smart question. If only it was true.
It was a great question. Yeah, you should have started the show with
You're
that.
You're very encouraging.
But honestly, it has a little bit of a skewness. The theme is not a I-10 freeway kind of piece. I mean, hopefully it isn't.
No, it's not.
You know, and it just sort of it wiggles around. I mean, it does sound pretty dreamy at times, but it was very precisely thought out. As a matter of fact, they extended the main title in season 3 and 4, and we had to go back and extend it by two bars. I was like, oh god, I mean, because we had an old mix, I had to have to recalibrate and get that sound so we could kind of punch in there. It was a bear, but you know, these are not too big a world problem, really.
Well, now that we're in the jazz mode, that brings us to a third main title track. Yes. And I'm happy to tell our listeners that this one did not get an Emmy nomination. Well, okay, it actually won the Emmy for Outstanding Original Main Title Theme Music. I'm not sure that's better, but it's fantastic. Congratulations. This is the main title theme from Marvel's Jessica Jones. Okay, I have to start with a full disclosure. That show was created by a very cool lady who I've known pretty well for the last 31 years because she's my wife, Melissa Rosenberg. And I will tell you this, I've rarely seen her as happy as she was when you won the Emmy for that music.
Oh, that's so cool to hear.
So walk us through this. How did you start forming the ideas for this music?
I have to tell you, and I'm not just saying this because you're married to Melissa, but she had a view, she had a kind of specificity to the show, and she reached out to me, she told me, because she'd heard some of Homeland, and she said, there's something in there that I think might be interesting, not an actual lift, but I just realized I like the music. But she used the word, she said, I think she coined the word, she goes, I'm thinking neo-noir. You know, and it's just a great. I mean, like, what does that mean? That means let that marinate. Take that like an aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read the script, and then, as you will know, in terms of guidelines and union rules, you can't see a pilot. You can't see a show in editing progress until the director has signed off on the cut.
Right.
So I wasn't legally allowed to look at anything moving images. So they brought me in and showed me slides. They created a slideshow, which I'd never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see still images of Kristen Ritter, the sets. And it was so, in a way, almost more informative to see still images. I'm sure I would have gotten something out of moving, but I really had a mosaic of just images. And I went
That's
home.
That's very cool. Yeah.
And she kept talking about her stealthiness, and I saw Jessica on fire escapes. I saw her in alleys and stuff. And when I got back to the piano, which is a small little piano at the house, the word that came to mind is she's sort of like a cat, a night cat. And I just the first three notes, da da da. You know, it was almost like a kitten on the keys.
Hmm.
And I said, I'm just going to follow that out. So I worked that on the piano, and then over the weekend I got a track together, and then you have this. And I kind of liked it. I hired a guitarist to come in and play on that. And by the way, I got to give a shout out to George Deering for Homeland and Jeff Lingle for Jessica Jones, because. So then I had something. Now I had no graphics yet. I didn't see the graphics or anything. I sent it to her, and I don't think I heard from her. I think she was traveling or something. So like, you know, when a day goes by, you know, a composer just hates this vacuum.
You're oh, like, no.
Oh, no. This is over. It's over. You just want people to call back immediately.
Right.
And they don't. And then she called, and she was thrilled. And then she stood by it. And what makes – I cannot stress how much having a strong showrunner helps a composer, because they protect the composer.
Mm-hmm.
They let them move around the cabin, play in the sandbox a little bit.
Yeah.
And they have to be protected from the forces above the showrunner.
Right.
Because if people come raining down with all kinds of notes and stuff from all different kinds of sources, and that has happened to me. And they do.
Sure.
It can disrupt, it can disorient you. But in the case of Jessica, she had a commitment to the specificity of the tone of it.
There's so much about that story I've never heard before. And particularly the part about you're seeing the still images.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, I'm involved in a lot of photography now.
Yes.
And I love still photography, fine art photography, because it's a much different relationship. You know, as a director, when I'm making film, bombarding the viewer with 24 frames a second, 24 pictures a second, and music and dialogue, and I'm trying to manipulate their emotions constantly. And when you look at a still image, you bring so much to it from yourself.
Yep.
So it's much more evocative in many ways than being fed everything.
Agreed. It was the first time I ever kind of took in visuals of a show that way, and I really think it was quite. I would do it again in a second.
I love the kitty on keys image. And it starts out very low-key, almost whimsical. And there is comedy in the series.
Yes.
Quite a bit, and drama. And then it builds to this place of tremendous energy and drama and passion before kind of resolving and bringing us back and going back to that little motif that you did.
And we got lucky there, because when they put the graphics together, if you ever look at the main title, mm-hmm. when it starts to get aggressive – I kind of had a feeling that with a Marvel show, even though this was a bit of a unique lane of color for Marvel,
mm-hmm.
you still wanted to convey this person's power. She's a very powerful person. So
right.
I had this idea of it kind of really building. And then the graphics went into the strobe effect with the lights of
Well, maybe Alex. Your music affected the
They never
the
heard it. They
oh,
never
really?
Heard it. It got sort of, it just lined up, you know, almost exactly, you know, it started getting busier. So whatever they were thinking.
Kismet.
Yeah, and then it plugged, and then thankfully Marvel signed off fairly quickly, which I was very, very happy about. And then to be nominated, plus you came to that awards ceremony.
I was there.
Yeah.
And you won.
And it was one of those 5-hour jobs, so you really put in – I mean, thank you.
It is.
It's just a bit of a barn burner. And look, going there is really quite a privilege. So,
yeah. I have two more annoying questions, and I want to play that again since we've been. And I like the fact that here we're on this doing the show. We can talk about the piece and then play it again. People can hear what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Hopefully, the guitar solo. I'm sure somebody could sit down and notate that, but how do you script it? Was it just kind of like hire a guitarist and say, dude, shred from bar 29 to bar 34? Or?
You know what I did?
What
did
you do?
Is I had a guitar-like sound on the piano.
Okay.
And that I did not write it out, but I had an idea as to its trajectory.
Okay.
And I don't play guitar, so if I could that might have been fun to grab that sketch and bring it in here and play. It was like blah, 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 blah. It was really broad stroking.
Okay.
And I sent it to my guitarist, who's also a music editor. He's a brilliant Jeff Lingle. And I said, look, this has got to be really, you know, energetic, and I want you to just sort of let yourself go into the energy of this. It's really building. And he did so many great takes. That was the hard part. And then I was really kind of hoping that particularly the last part of the solo would be particularly good, because I said there's going to be probably a lot of people skipping past the main title after the first or second episodes. I want them to hear that tale. I want that part to be perfect, because if they don't hear the main title, I want them to hear the last 25 seconds perfectly.
Awesome. All right. Well, now we need to hear this again. So here, once again, is the main title theme from the show, Jessica Jones. I just love everything about that piece. I love the piano parts. I love the bass line. And the production is very sophisticated. It's very Eno-esque, you know, with the little specular bits of reverb guitar layered through it. And I imagine you must have been very involved in how that came together in the mix. Or did you mix the whole thing on your console?
Pardon me. Yes, I did. And it was you don't know how it's going to come out. I actually think mixing – I have a bit of OCD, so mixing is actually a bit I have to be careful, because I'll just spiral down and kill it. You can actually kill something.
Right.
You know, you love something, you want it to be perfect, and you end up killing it. And
dear.
You don't want to kill it. You
know, well.
So, yeah. So,
folks, we are talking to award-winning composer Sean Callery. We're going to take a quick break to thank some of the folks who make this radio station possible. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Sean's work and share some of his favorite musical moments from film and TV, including a movie score from John Williams about a certain very large shark. Be right back after this.
June is Pride Month, and 88.5 The SoCal Sound recognizes all the LGBTQ+ artists who make our rainbow of music so colorful.
Are you looking to spread the word about your business or tell performing arts and music fans about your show, concert, or event? The SoCal Sound is a new DIY online underwriting platform that's an easy way to begin airing your messages. It's a simple, quick, and affordable way to reach people across LA and Orange County with messages about your business. And you'll be supporting this public music station. For 10% off your first campaign, use code INTRO10 at thesocalsoundontap.org. That's thesocalsoundontap.org.
LCD Sound Systems 8-Night Los Angeles Residency comes to the Shrine Expo Hall Halloween night through November 3rd and to the Hollywood Palladium November 7th through 10th. Thanks to our friends at Live Nation and Golden Voice, current members can find contest rules and enter to be eligible for a pair of tickets at thesocalsound.org. No purchase necessary. Tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. LCD Sound System, 8 nights in LA, at the Hollywood Palladium and the Shrine Expo Hall.
Don't you want me to wake up? Then give me just a bit of
88.5 The SoCal Sound.
N-E-W.
Your station for new music discovery.
We are back with composer extraordinaire Sean Callery, and the piece we're listening to is one of his favorites, the main theme from the film Cinema Paradiso, written by composer Ennio Morricone. Sean, I'd asked you to tell me some of your all-time favorite pieces of music from film and TV, and this was the first one you mentioned. Certainly a beautiful piece. Can you tell us what is it about Morricone's music that affects you so much?
What a question. I saw this movie only once in college, and It just had a profound effect on me at that time in my life. There's something at once heartbreaking and inspirational and uplifting about his music to me. Which is why I think it remains somewhat timeless when you listen to The Mission, The Untouchables. I mean, There's such a specificity of choice. But in this movie, I saw it once, and at the end of the film, there's a scene where the aging director is watching a movie of all the scenes that were deemed too racy for the community that were cut by the priest, and they're put all together, and he starts crying. And I was so moved. The movie moved me. I don't know how I'd feel if I see it again. It's just the score is somewhat of a... Sometimes music can be a bit of a time machine. It conjures up where you've been and what was going on in your life.
Well, here's a question for you. Are you able to enjoy watching film and television, or are you constantly analyzing the music in them instead?
I don't enjoy any of it.
Oh, no.
No, I'm kidding. I will be honest about something. I do like watching shows without music, like Seinfeld. Seinfeld has music. It's a great Jonathan Wolf's.
They have the little stings in between the scenes.
But it is impossible. You listen to a show, and you're watching it, and you love it. And if you're really into it, a part of me will always be thinking and hearing the music, and if it's really great, it's a great companion to it. It's great. Sometimes you listen to it and you go, "Hey, how did that person do that? That is so freaking good," you know. And other times, sometimes my wife, who's not in the industry, she'll hear something and I'll think it's great. She goes, "I don't like this." I go, "Why?" She goes, "It's distracting. It's you know, to each his own." It's interesting. Some things that I think are, I love her view of music in film and TV, because she appreciates music. She actually does sing, but she's not in the industry, so she sees things very
clearly
in a raw, clear way. And I actually think she has a very intuitive sense about.
I know that for me, the better something is when I'm watching film and television, the more I'm sucked into the characters and the storytelling. So if I'm noticing the director's work, that's not a good thing. It means I'm not as involved as I want to be. So here's the great paradox of score, right? We want it to be great, and we want to not notice it at the same time. And that's such a fine line to walk sometimes, no?
Homeland was probably the ultimate example of that, because Homeland was shot almost like a documentary. They wanted it to look so real world. And the paradox is, the moment you bring in score, well, that's not real world. What is there, a band in the corner of the CIA room playing some pads or something? So that was a show where they really weren't a fan of melody. The melody, if it got in the way of anything, even when there wasn't any dialogue, it sometimes just in the eyes of certain people, it was just too much.
That's fascinating.
Other shows are like Halo, which I did, the first season of Halo. Very melodic, very, very aggressive and in your face at times. So it's really about the it depends on the dance you're
it depends on the dance you're at.
Well, let me back up and ask a more generalized question. What makes a great underscore for you? Morricone clearly checked the boxes that you mentioned. Are there other boxes? What do you strive for when you're writing a score?
I would say, Jessica. For me, what a question. I mean, I'm thinking of movies like at the end of E.T., for example, when you've, at the end of this huge emotional journey, the music just arrives in full relief. It completely owns the moment and you are swept away. And that does happen for me when the music, and also, if I may, the spotting is where the music is. And I think that is an art form, to decide where is music going to go? Where is it not going to go? Sometimes the most incredible moments, you may have examples of yourself, there's no score at some of the most hugest moments in the show, or there's a big moment of score. It's about the artistry of it. It's about choices and so forth. Melissa was very good at this. Can I amend one answer? You know what makes a good score? It's one that doesn't try to manipulate you. It's one that doesn't try to force you into a place.
So you're coming from a place of subtlety.
Subtlety and just natural, organic. You know, you arrive at a moment organically, and the music supports that. If you're being ramrodded into feel this, you know,
right.
Laugh here, you know,
right.
That kind of thing.
Very interesting answer. Yeah. By the way, who's the drummer on that? I really like that guy or her.
That was a combination of me, believe it or not, on just a stand-up set, and I think my old assistant who worked, who had a drum set.
Nice. Well, we've been talking about what makes a great score, and another quite famous piece of music that you picked out as one of your favorites is a very specific cue from composer John Williams called Man Against Beast, from the first film that made Spielberg famous, Jaws. Tell us generally why you picked this piece.
I think the best scores I've ever heard are the ones that completely marry the artistry and the beauty of writing with the craft that's required to serve a picture, that serves picture. Every great scene has an arc to it. It has a beginning and a middle and end, and there are moments that the scene changes and evolves, and sometimes you can write a piece of music that you aspire will be in the end a piece of music, actually something that plays, and when it does so and hits 8 or 9 sync points that are so important that you choose to define as a moment that you want to recognize, and it happens with effortlessness and elegance, that stands out. And this is a 48-year-old cue or 47-year-old cue, which I just think demonstrates so many moving parts.
You put that very eloquently. So we're going to try something now, unheard of in the annals of radio. Probably not. I don't know, Mookie. What do you think?
Well, I feel like you're changing the game just generally. You know,
changing the game.
Game-changing. Thank you for
and it
thank
happened, you for Mookie. It happened here.
Sorry, it took me a while to actually figure out how to turn my mic on.
There was a guy who sounded just like you on the show before us. But what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and we're going to play this piece of score. It's about 5 minutes long, just the music, not dialogue and effects. And I'm going to kind of narrate what's happening in the film. And Sean, I want you to talk about the music as we'll do kind of play-by-play and color commentary. So I'm just going to set the scene for us for the nobody out there who hasn't actually seen the film Jaws. But there are three men out on a small fishing boat trying to catch a shark that's killed swimmers on the beach. Roy Scheider plays Police Chief Brody. Robert Shaw plays the boat's Captain Quint. And Richard Dreyfuss is Marine Biologist Hooper. And the first beat of music happens as Brody is throwing bloody chum into the ocean behind the boat, and suddenly the giant shark rears out of the water and scares the living heck out of Brody. Okay, so you ready? Here we go. Let's see if I got this in the right place. Almost. So this is great radio right here. We are making history. Hang on. I've got it. Okay. Go for it.
That's when the head comes up. You see it for the first time.
And Brody backs into the cabin where Quint is fooling around with the radio, and he says,
we're going to need a bigger boat.
And now listen, this is a little sea shanty theme here. It's Quinn.
I think it's kind of a Quinn thing.
He goes, you're going to need a bigger boat. He looks out.
They come to the back of the boat, and they're looking out, and here comes...
Master Shot of the Shark. It's coming right towards the boat.
It's coming to the boat. It's swimming towards them.
And Quinn says, shut off that engine. And then Spielberg brilliantly just lets... It's going to cross in front of the boat now, and the music's going to swell.
There are shots of all three of them just staring in horror. Now it's coming under the boat, and you see how big this thing is compared to the men.
That's a 20-footer. 25.
They're staring, transfixed, kind of disbelieving.
3 tons of them, 2 tons. Now, this is, we got to get to work beat. This is them all going in 3 different directions.
Okay.
Quint's getting a harpoon. Dreyfus is grabbing a camera.
Yep.
And Brody is like, what are we doing? Like, they're kind of all moving around.
Brody's kind of like, we need to go in to the land.
He's sort of the viewer. Immediately. He's sort of the viewer. He's a surrogate viewer. He wants what the viewer wants. Let's get out of here.
Now, there's a shot here of the feet on the side of the boat, and somebody slips. Yep. And you're like, oh, God, don't slip in the water. But he doesn't...
Doesn't do anything with that.
He doesn't hang a lantern on that.
But this is... you hear all this nautical kind of stuff that's in there, which is great. It has a bit of playfulness and adventure and excitement. It's not just all...
It's not like horror just, yet.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And there's a shot of the shark right here. There it is. And this becomes a little bit of a humor beat.
Yes, so Hooper is telling Brody, get out on the bowsprit, get out on the front. He says, why? And he sees the shark.
Yep.
He's like, I need you in the foreground to get scale. And Brody really does not want to go out there. He finally says...
But the writing is just... the churning and the... And he's getting out of the dialogue.
This is... Scheider's trying to get back in the boat, and suddenly this harpoon appears, and he has to back up.
Harpoon, right there. I don't know if that was intentional, but it's perfect. Now, the music is getting more focused. He goes, Chief, I want you to go steer the boat.
Right.
It's getting more like, they're getting now more aligned in terms of what
intentional.
Yes, exactly.
So he's told Hooper to tie the barrel onto his harpoon line, but Hooper instead goes inside to get this radio telemetry device.
And so now we're coming to sort of the climax of the... This is the... He's coming.
Shark.
He's coming.
Shark
he's
is coming. Coming.
And it's such a... Oh, it's so...
And there's rising tension because we see a shot where the line is not tied onto the barrel. The shark is coming. He's going to have to shoot it.
Hooper, get over here. He goes, don't wait for me.
Hooper!
And now this is just pure suspense. Is he going to get the shot out or not?
The shark's coming closer.
The build. Let's listen to this how much.
Come on. He's lining up to take the shot.
Shoot!
And he gets it, and Hooper gets the barrel tied off just in time, and now they're chasing the barrel.
Now listen to this music. This is like adventure, like almost swashbuckling. We are heroes of the sea. We're going to get this guy, you know.
It is Errol Flynn.
We're winning. You know, it's just such, it is such a relief.
They're chasing after this barrel. We see the barrel being dragged across the surface.
They're going to win. They're going to win. And then what happens? Rings.
Dun, 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 dun.
They're going down along with
the barrel goes down,
which is
it disappears.
I mean, it's just such a
they're all looking very disappointed. The skies are very clouded over and ominous looking all of a sudden. And now we see the shot of the boat silhouetted against the setting sun. They're out on the open ocean with a very large monster underneath them somewhere.
Somewhere. Letting the space happen now. Just letting the space, the boat, they're kind of breathing afterwards, you know. Like, and Quint's like, he's actually very relaxed out there. He's like looking around. And then I think that's a time cut, if I'm not mistaken.
This is now the sun has set, and you see just the boat out on the ocean with...
I mean, I just think that's as good as it gets for me. And I know it's an older cue. There's plenty of newer cues in the world that do wonderful things. We were talking, and I thought... And I don't know if this is going to play well, because I probably talked way too much over it. I probably just should have let the music play. But this is what I was listening to at the age of 12. You know,
just, we just got to hear lots of it. Yeah, and that was thank you for talking us through that. Wow. That was really cool. You know. I've got another piece that you mentioned is another one of your favorites. Let's try this one. I'm just going to play this.
Oh.
I apologize. There are some of the sound effects mixed in with the music on this. I now associate that music with the film. That's Barber's Adagio for Strings. It was used throughout the film Platoon, directed by Oliver Stone.
Yes.
And I primarily remember it being used over the aftermath of the huge third act battle as Charlie Sheen emerges from his foxhole and he's stumbling around the battlefield seeing the terrible, terrible devastation of the scenery and the humans. But he uses it all throughout the film, I think, as well.
Yes, he does. And it's funny, again... When we were talking about this, you were asking me about scenes that affected me, and I guess I went back to the times I saw these films. You know, there are modern films that do extraordinary things, but this is a case where a classical composer, Samuel Barber. It's interesting that Oliver Stone's use of it now almost permanently marries that piece to the film, like the William Tell Overture, for example.
Yeah,
you know, to the Lone Ranger. But it's profoundly moving against all the, I think, would you agree? I mean, the carnage and all the suffering. This is speaking almost to the...
Yeah, I think he's using it to underscore the horror and futility of war. Yeah. It's got this somber, haunting melody that underscores the deep sense of tragedy and loss experienced by the soldiers. And it's interesting that he scored that with a classical piece because a lot of the soundtrack is needle drops.
Right.
And again, Melissa says, I need to explain this stuff. So a needle drop is
a
pre-recorded existing piece of music, often popular songs. And in this case, he was evoking the time period of the late 60s with music from The Doors and Otis Redding and Jefferson Airplane and Smokey Robinson. And here he's got this classical piece.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those... If we look in the world of television, for example, one of the best series I ever saw on HBO, The Wire, that is score. It is completely just real world. Any music you hear in that score in The Wire is just what people are hearing on the streets of Baltimore. And it's just an extraordinarily powerful presentation, you know, an execution. Oh.
While we're back in the classical realm, I'd love to ask you about the process of recording orchestral score. I can't believe how quickly this is going.
We're almost done.
Skip to the end.
That's okay.
But this is a great orchestral piece you wrote for the 2011 TV miniseries, The Kennedys.
Yeah.
It's a great cue. It makes me want to watch the series. How does this music evolve from your piano score to sheet music for 60 musicians?
I haven't heard this in a while, so this for some reason was one of my favorite projects to work on with Joel Cerno. It starred Greg Kinnear, Barry Pepper, who won an Emmy.
Yeah,
I was nominated for the theme, which was really an honor.
Well, of course you were.
Well, you know, not everything. You know, no, it doesn't. There's when you think the Kennedys, there are some things. There's things about the American experience and the trumpet was a natural thing that I came. It was patriotic.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just explore the patriotic, a really great patriotic theme if I could.
Do you ever conduct the orchestra? Is that something you like to do?
I've done it overseas. I've done it here at UCLA. Yeah. I actually love conducting. And I got a piece of advice once from Don Davis. It was like, every composer should conduct their music because you really are
communicating probably as directly as you possibly can with your hand movements. Your music is coming out of them, and you're and also conductors live long. Did you know that?
No,
they have long lifespans because of the exercise. There's something about conductors. They live long lives.
I wonder if it's too late to take it up.
No, it's not. it's not. We should all be conductors.
Well, I'd have to go back to your conservatory and start there, I think.
No. It's I do enjoy it. I'm not a pro. I mean, I'm not Dudamel. I mean, Dudamel has everyone just literally almost reading his mind, you know, the way he moves his hand. I've talked to the
musicians. They say they have to watch him because he'll change things in the middle of the performance.
And maybe that's part of why we love it so much. There's a bit of spontaneity and unpredictability to it.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I don't think people realize the complexity of undertaking an orchestral score like that. But here, I want to play another piece for you. I know we have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
This is a very highly technical and complex orchestral piece that I'd like to play. You also mentioned this show when I asked about your favorite. So, folks, listen to the orchestration going on in this piece. Ready? Here goes. This, of course, for anyone who's been under a rock for the past 34 years, is the main title theme from The Simpsons, written by Danny Elfman. Sean Callery, you've now put Stravinsky and The Simpsons in the same category of Callery favorites. Tell us why.
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, I think the theme is... It's
brilliant.
It survives. Yeah. I mean, it lives on. There's... I don't know how to quite say this. The Simpsons is a... It's an animated show and has comedy. It's comedic moments, and when it's scored very straight ahead. It's not scored with putting your elbow into someone else and saying, "Hey, isn't this funny?" It's just naturally playing the real world weirdness. Now, this theme just has such joy and playfulness and fun and clarity. All the parts are, you can hear every part over and over again. Oh, there's they change that every time in the couch.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's just a great theme. It makes you, everyone in this room, including Mookie, we smiled. We all smiled when we heard it, the moment we heard it. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. I wanted to play another cue, but now I feel bad because we just don't have very much time left talk to you. So can we skip a couple?
Yeah. Where do we want to go?
Let's go. Let's see. Well, let's hear the Halo action cue because that's another one that Sean wrote.
Oh.
And we can go into the Cary Brody star. That'd
be the. I don't understand your lingo here. Are we talking about the Halo main title?
Yeah. That one.
Oh, let's do that.
I think that's it.
I love that.
How do you approach action scenes, Sean? Actions scenes, Sean. Sorry.
It's like any. Basically, you look at a scene like you look at any scene. What are you playing? What's the story? Where are you coming from? Are you telling the story through the eyes of a character? Are you telling it sort of in a third person kind of narrator way? There's all kinds of choices. There's no stock answer to that. This is the main title.
No, the stock question. But thank you for the. This is the main title.
Yeah, it's the main title. And Marty O'Donnell wrote the video game, and it had such a phenomenal theme, and we included that in the opening of this. So then I had to put a new theme in because they wanted a separate canon.
I feel like you're giving us a master class in composing right now. I hope that young composers will listen to this and hear some of the answers you're giving because they're pretty profound.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that's nice. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, and then we go into thank you. Yeah, there we go. That was a fun show too. That was a 21-year-old. Franchise. I mean, that was a daunting thing.
So there's no, you know, there's a stupid question to follow up on your very good answer. Are there any givens in action? Like, oh, okay, the tempos are going to be faster. There's going to be more percussion, more rhythmic drive. It's louder. You know, do you ever try to go the other way and do counterpoint and do something really quiet against action?
Absolutely. I just finished watching the series Shogun, and
I love that show.
It was wonderfully done. It had such beautiful takes on action. It was Atticus Ross, Nick Chuba, and Leopold Ross.
Okay.
And they just did very
just interesting things with action. Sometimes it was pure driving, you know, with percussion, and sometimes it wasn't. And sometimes it spoke in a different way, and that wakes up. There we go. Yeah.
Sorry to distract you with your own beautiful music.
That's all right. This is Carrie's theme. This was the first piece of music I ever wrote for the series.
I had so many more questions for you, but that hour just zipped by like it was 10 minutes.
You warned me, and
minutes.
I answered too long. I'm sorry.
No. Your answers were brilliant and fascinating. Thank you for those. Guys, I want to thank our guest, Sean Callery, for being on with us.
Thank you,
really
Lev.
Great hour talking about music, and I learned so much talking to you.
You got
to
do this more and wider. I don't know if it's podcast world or stay this way, whatever, but thank you. I mean, beautiful hour with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, if we have any marketing type folk out there who know how to do a podcast, send me an email.
Not putting this place down, by the way. Mickey, thank you. I mean, this is...
Oh, my pleasure. Great show, guys. Really, really amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I'm afraid we have to wrap up and get back to our programming, the rest of our